Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners go to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth.
Welcome into another episode of the Money Insights Podcast. Thanks for joining us. My name is Christian Allen. I'm your host. With me, as always, on the other line, Rodney the Pod Zabriskie. Rod, what's up, man?
Hey, glad to be here.
Okay, and so guess what?
Yeah.
I just cut you off. Guess what?
What's up?
This is big news. I'm in my new house. I'm doing the first recording in the new house. So to be fair, it could be a little bit echoey, but we're trying to like makeshift some of the things. Here's the good news, though. By the time we record next week, it should be completely ready to rock and roll. We shouldn't have any sound problems. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, no, that is exciting. This is a monumental day.
Yeah, by the way, thanks again for driving an hour down here to help me get it set up. That was good of you.
Yeah, beautiful house.
Thanks. Okay, so sorry, I cut you off. What's up, Rod?
Oh, I was actually going to make the same comment, something about, hey.
Okay, so we're on the same page.
This is a big deal, yeah.
Okay, yep. Awesome. Well, as much fun as it is for people to hear about the new house, the new office, I'm guessing that's not the primary reason that people are tuning in. So we're going to switch our focus a little bit today, and we're going to do our very first episode of what we're calling Money Insights with Money Insights. And we're going back and forth on the name. Like, to be fair, it could change, right? Like, you get it, Money Insights with Money. It makes sense, right? But it's kind of long. And so anyway, if anyone has any better names for this, then just let us know. What we're going to do, though, is we're going to do our question and answer, and we're going to talk through five of the most commonly asked questions that we see on a day-to-day basis. And Rod meets with about 50 people a week, or at least feels like that,
sometimes,
right?
Yeah.
Maybe 25. And as a group, we meet with a ton of people, and so we get some of these questions over and over, and they're really great questions. And so we figured we'd take the opportunity to answer them in a little bit more detail, one by one, and kind of get into the deep dive on it.
Give some money insights on the questions.
Yes, well said, insights. We're going to give some insights into these questions. Now, before we move into the questions, I have to ask a favor. If there are things that you would like answered, now, we don't have like a speak pipe or anything yet, but we'll get one. We'll get something where you can call in or come in and record the question. But until then, if anyone has any questions they would love for us to answer, or like for us to answer on the show, we're happy to do it. We've had a handful of people write in on different subjects they're interested in, and that's always super helpful because it gives us some direction on what people are really interested in. Okay, so without further ado, Rodney, let's jump into our five most commonly asked questions.
Sweet, I'm ready.
Number one, this is like kind of at the core of what we are, of who we are and what we do. But the question is, and I'm going to let you take a stab at this one first, but why are you convinced, Rod, why are you convinced that alternative asset investing is the way to go? You talk a lot about this whole alternative asset investing thing, and I would love to know what makes you think it's so great.
I think, so for me, anyone who you know, listened to our bio podcast or whatever, you know that I was put on the track to where I am today because of a little book called The Rich Dad, Poor Dad, right? And a lot of people we talk to have similar experiences.
I was about to comment on how uncommon it is for us to hear that.
Yeah, exactly. So, and just really quickly, the reason I bring that up in this question is that one of the major premises to that is that as it relates to preparing for retirement income, the best way to do it is to create streams of income that can replace your working income. And so someone might say, well, that's kind of what I'm doing when I'm putting money into my 401k or my brokerage account. I'm building this up so I can turn that into my stream of income. Well, the challenge with that is how do I know how much income that's going to produce? I don't.
That is a challenge, and that's why we always end up talking about that horrible 4% rule.
Yeah.
Because people don't know a better place to do it, and so that's just become like the easy alternative because, you know, everything else is based on projections and hard to create real numbers around.
Yeah. Yeah. And so on the other hand, if I'm investing in businesses, real estate, notes, other things like that, that are producing real income, then I know. And I want to do it from multiple streams. I don't want to rely on any one place alone, right? No, don't put all your eggs in one basket, that type of philosophy. But if I can create streams of income from different places that replace my working income, then I know when I'm ready to retire.
Well, right? And so this is kind of the key. Streams of income is so difficult in the traditional marketplace, right? If you're talking about stocks, bonds, mutual funds exclusively,
yep.
If you start adding in things like REITs and other things, you can, and you know, bonds can be obviously better at creating income, but they're not the same as like creating a guaranteed replacement of income, right?
Right.
And not only that, it would take a whole lot more money, a whole lot more capital to accomplish that same objective if you were doing it all in bonds versus what you could do with real estate.
Right.
And one of the other big things, Rod, is just that you don't have the same kind of influence on those kind of investments. They're passive. And while real estate can be passive, those types of alternatives can be passive, you still have a lot more control over the way that they're running, right? So like velocity is an example, right? I have control over some of these factors that I just don't have the same control over if I'm, you know, primarily an index fund investor, for example.
Yeah, for sure. And that's just one aspect of alternative investing. There are a lot of other things that are just create more advantages for me than I can get. Tax planning, for example. There are things I can do.
Have let you go first, Rod. You're going to take all my points. Just kidding. Actually,
it.
We're good. I have 4 or 5 points,
okay.
And so far you haven't even taken them up. So I'm just kidding.
Okay, good.
We're good.
Okay, so I'll let you go after this. But okay. Yeah, the tax. There are things I can do in the alternative space that I just can't do in the traditional, you know, way of doing things from a tax planning standpoint. So we work with a lot of people who are self-employed. But even W-2 people, right? There are just different things that you can do when you spread out and get into the alternative investing space from a tax planning standpoint that you just can't do in the traditional space.
Yeah. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about some of the tax planning concepts you can use in the traditional space here in a few minutes.
Sweet.
Okay. I've got a handful of reasons. Can I take a turn
at
it?
I'm ready. Yeah.
All right. Let's do this. Okay. So first one, the first and maybe the most pertinent, is that the most important? I don't know if those are the right words, but impactful. Let's go that.
Okay.
The most impactful reason for me is that I have 15, 16 years of personal experience meeting with people, meeting with clients. The first 10 years was primarily, maybe not the first 10, 7 or 8 years was primarily in that traditional space, right?
Yeah.
And I saw it, and I saw the types of people I was meeting with, it was just so much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't seeing nearly as many people with high incomes and high net worth. And, you know, while some of that has to do with my own career projection or trajection, a lot of it is just has to do with the types of people who are real estate investors and alternative asset investors, because they do want to generally, they're usually working for something a little bit more. So it's almost like there's two tracks, right? One track is the, I'm going to be a millionaire by 65 by putting money in index funds, and I can absolutely do that. Like, that is a track. And if you love your work and your job and you're comfortable with this, with the long, steady road, then it can be a really great way for people to go. Having said that, what ends up happening is generally the types of people that we meet with want to drastically accelerate the pace at which they're getting to that point.
Right.
And so so those are the same people that end up becoming attracted to and investing in alternative assets. Therefore, my experience tells me that, you know, of the people that I've met with that are, let's say, multimillionaires, and we've met with, you know, maybe thousands, at least 8,000, and I would say 80% of those that reaching that place are primarily investing in the alternative space, maybe they have some of the traditional stuff baked in there through you know, qualified plans or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's my first. My first point is personal experience tells me that it's just been more effective. People tend to get there when they use alternative investments more quickly, more easily than if they're using traditional stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. Okay, the next one is leverage. This is another one, and this is huge. Mm-hmm. Leverage is so much more difficult to come for, to get to in the traditional space. Like, while I can, you know, trade on margin, most people don't ever trade on margin, mm-hmm. right? Most people don't have the expertise, comfort level to be able to do it and do it effectively.
Yeah.
On the other hand, how many people do you know, Rod, that own a home and purchased their home using leverage and have therefore benefited from the appreciation over that time?
Almost everyone that I know. There was that one
guy.
If you owned
anything in the last 10 years, that's who you were, right?
Yeah. There was one guy that didn't want to buy his house until he could save up enough to do that. And while I respect kind of the principle behind what he was doing, it was a little unfortunate for him.
So my point was a little long-winded, Rod, but the point is that it's so much easier to add leverage, and leverage is the math that accelerates wealth building. Period. End of story. If you've got somebody with the exact same income, saving the exact same amount of money, one's utilizing leverage, the other isn't, you're going to go down the road and it's going to be a drastic difference in what they're able to accumulate in terms of, you know, true wealth.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. Okay, good. So we're on the same page on that. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about this concept of risk-adjusted return. I hit on it here and there because I think it's important. The other thing that is interesting is that alternative assets probably shouldn't be called alternative assets, right? Because they're a lot more common, I would even say. I mean, they've been around for a long time. It's kind of a silly thing. But that said, what ends up happening is because it's quote unquote an alternative asset or an alternative investment, there's this idea that it's inherently of greater risk. There's just more risk associated with it. And the reason for that has nothing to do with the underlying risk factors, and it has everything to do with the way people think about it, what they know about it. Kind of, you know, again, it's alternative. Alternative means risky. Those two have just kind of come together like they're one. And what I would do is I would suggest to people to challenge that thought and understand this concept of risk-adjusted return and just do enough due diligence to look and see. And what one of the things that you'll find that was surprising even to me originally was just that many of these alternative assets, which are quote unquote more risky, actually carry a much better risk-adjusted return profile.
Right.
And the risk-adjusted return profile is just a simple formula to determine how the return versus your risk and really differentiate one investment or compare one investment from another.
Can I give an example?
Please.
So we are familiar with a group that does real estate syndicating. And if you're not familiar with that term, it's basically a way that a whole bunch of investors can pool their money to buy, in this case, it's multifamily apartment buildings, and together kind of go in and make an investment that I as an individual wouldn't be able to participate by myself, or maybe wouldn't even want to if I could, but by doing it as a group, it makes it more palatable and better. So this particular operator that we're familiar with, to me, has, relatively speaking, very little risk associated with the deals that they do. They're very specific in the type of properties they're looking for, and they'll only buy those properties. Once they get into a property, they have a very specific process they go through to value add, increase the value of the property, and turn it over. And so because of that, because they have a great track record, they have a system, they have a process, I can actually probably get higher returns with that group. And I'm taking on less risk when I do it with them as compared to other syndication operators that are out there and maybe aren't as streamlined or specific or those kinds of things that, that just differentiate this particular group. So it's not the typical risk reward curve that you're used to. This puts them on a very low risk, relatively speaking, and yet the return is
they've been amazing.
Potential is greater.
Yep, I would agree. And that's, again, another part of the alternative assets. There's just options that people just generally don't know about that produce greater returns more consistently. Okay, I have one more thing, and then we're finally going to move off of question number one.
Okay.
My other reason for being convinced is just my own personal experience. And you talk about how I've personally invested. Well, I can tell you this. The greatest asset that I've invested in is my business.
Yeah.
Right, which would certainly be considered a, again, quote unquote, alternative asset. But just by investing in the business and focusing on it, you know, we've been able to become like multimillionaires from it. And that's just something that's so difficult to do. And just if I were just to be socking away money, going to work each day and accomplishing that. So that's an example. But then as we've been able to accomplish more as a business, we've now started to look at other alternative options for investing. And even in the short time that we've begun doing that as a business, we're starting to see more opportunity and more profit than we would otherwise.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are my four reasons. Hopefully they weren't so discombobulated that people can understand.
Oh, they were combobulated. I think you did a good job.
That's a good word. Okay, I like it. They were combobulated. Okay, Rod, we're going to move into question number two. And this is one we get all the time. Mm-hmm. We adjusted it slightly, but as a high-income earner, should I contribute to a qualified plan? Now, I should probably just describe what a qualified plan is, because sometimes I get in the habit of saying this terminology and realizing that not everybody else talks about this stuff every day. Yeah. Qualified plan just means it's qualified by the IRS, and so it's tax qualified. An example of this would be a 401k, an IRA, a 403b, any of those types of plans are considered qualified plans because they have some additional type of tax treatment. So did I describe that okay?
Yeah,
do you want to add anything to it?
Well, especially when you start mentioning the types of plans, I think most people are familiar with what a 401k is, what an IRA is.
Yep, IRA, 401k, et cetera. Yeah. And we'll get into those here in just a minute. Okay, so then the question is, Rod, as a high-income earner, should I contribute to those plans? And maybe I'll let you take a stab at it first, since I just chatted for the last 15 minutes and people are done listening to me. So tell us, Rod, whether high-income earners should contribute to qualified plans.
I would say maybe.
Oh, come on. You've got to do better than that.
That's my answer. That's my answer.
No, okay. There's no fence sitters here.
Okay, here's the thing. if I'm a...
I'm just teasing, by the way.
And well, should I use the other word that people level up? Depends. It really depends.
It does. And let's face it. Most of the answers are that it depends, right? It's always hard to use, you know, hard, fast.
Absolutes, like, yeah.
They just generally don't work. So
yeah, hopefully people have learned that from us.
With the qualification, Rod, that... It depends. Generally speaking, as a high-income earner, what would you say to this question and why?
Okay, so I would say if someone understands that money that you're contributing into a qualified plan, a lot of people think of it as tax savings. And it may...
Right, I put that money in, and now I don't have to pay as many taxes, right? So,
yeah.
So I get my IRA contribution, I pay my $5,000 or $6,000, and that's $5,000 or $6,000 less money going into my income. So therefore, I just save taxes.
Yeah,
right.
That's the way that it's presented. CPAs across the country are doing this on a regular basis. They look
hey,
at your
I'm
numbers.
I'm interested in hearing your description
say,
of what's actually happening.
Yeah, the CPA looks at your numbers and they tell you what you owe in taxes, and then when your accountants falls, they say, "But I have a solution."
Yes, they do. And if you're like. You know, if you're really lucky, you might even get to like a simple IRA, and then you can save like, you know, 12, maybe it's up to 14,000 now, right?
Yeah. So, or
so
a
anyway,
SEP. I mean, go.
That's
50,
crazy.
You
know?
No
one's bringing up that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. That's of course being facetious. That those are the main things that CPAs are driving people to.
Yeah. And, but so just to maybe go back on my point, it's, if I'm in the same tax bracket today when I put that money aside as I will be in the future when I take that money out in retirement, there's no tax savings. I will have I will have paid the same, or I will end up with the same number of dollars in my pocket as I would have either way.
So,
whether I put it in the qualified plan or not, I'm going to have the same.
Okay, so in order to determine on the front end whether you're going to save taxes, you'd have to know two things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to know the tax rate that is going to be there when you pull money out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And you'd have to know what your income level is going to be. Now, you can probably plan at least somewhat for income, although, again, this is a tricky one because most people would prefer to have similar income in their quote-unquote retirement years as they would in their working years.
Right.
And so anyway, okay, so but those are the things I'd have to know in advance, right?
Yep. Makes it easy, right? Because we know what tax rates are going to do in the future. At least most people
think.
Yeah,
simple.
They
right.
know what they're
going
to do.
Yeah, just take out the crystal ball and then you'll know for sure. No, that is a challenge though, Rod. I think you bring up a really important point. If you don't know those factors, then it really becomes difficult to determine whether it's actually going to be a wise financial move. Now, I'll say this. If you are a 55-year-old making $500,000 or $600,000 a year, and you haven't saved a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
and you know you're staring at retiring in 10 years, and you've been a late saver. Well, if you're in that situation, it very well could make sense to max out any type of qualified plan that you have. In fact, we've done this a handful of times over the years with physicians I think I did it with a dentist one time.
Mm-hmm,
and really it was because they needed some catch up, right? And so we knew for a fact that their income was going to be significantly lower. And so it made sense to do that. I would suggest though, for this question in general, I do not think it's wise in general for high income earners to go to qualified plans. And again, the reason goes back to what you're saying. It's not an actual tax savings.
Right.
Now, let me clarify one thing, because I think if someone's listening to this and they might be like, wait a minute. Okay, if you're getting like a match on your 401k, like you're getting a solid match,
mm-hmm.
or let's say that you have a defined benefit plan and the company's putting a significant amount of money into that, like, okay, of course you want to be participating in and maybe even contributing to get the best to maximize your match with it. But above and beyond that, there's just better places to put it that can create real tax savings, right? We talk about real estate and depreciation. Those kinds of things can create real tax savings that you just can't get inside of the traditional space. You can get a lot of places to tax defer money. It's harder to find ways to tax save.
And that's the key. I think you hit on it right there. What are my alternatives? If I'm going to look at any question like this, where's the best place to put my money? Well, what are my alternatives? What else could I consider in place of putting it into a qualified account? And if I like those better, then I'm going to go for that. And again, hopefully we've made a pretty compelling, at least make people think that there are other alternatives out there that could be better, and at least understand what they are and then make a decision.
Yeah, that's great. Got to do a cost-benefit analysis. But again, most people don't even know that there's other things out there. And so if you don't know, you just don't look for them. Okay.
Yep.
And, 10 years ago, I didn't know some of those things. And so I was recommending that people go into qualified plans, just not knowing that there were better alternatives. Okay. Rod, I think this next question flows perfectly from the last question. So here it is. Can I invest in alternative assets with qualified money? Okay, so let's just
say... I see what you did there. You just brought the first two questions together in one.
We just brought them together, right? We just
Perfect.
Brought them together. Okay, so here's the deal. Let's just say you are one of those people who's... Let's say at number two, you're with us and you're like, you know what? It really doesn't make sense to... As a high-income earner, I'm not a fan of qualified plans. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But let's just say theoretically... Up until that very moment, 30 seconds ago, you just had no idea that that was a bad idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you've learned, you understand kind of, okay, there's some other things I ought to be looking at, but I've got all my money saved in qualified plans already.
Yeah.
right? So now I've got my, you know, my couple million bucks there with my company 401k and a bunch of, you know, maybe a couple of rollover IRAs. The question now is, I've started to kind of have my eyes open to this alternative space. Can I use this money to invest in alternatives? That's the question.
Answer is yes.
Brilliant. And let's move on.
Okay.
Just kidding. And we probably better give a little more than that.
Yeah. The way that you do that will depend. If you are self-employed, then you'll have more options than others. And I'm sorry if we keep talking about it this way and you're a W-2 person and you're thinking, man, it why don't I get more options?
It just goes back to the cash flow quadrant.
Yeah, it does.
Like, it's not our fault, right? Just think right. Just think of the cash flow quadrant. Like, as much as we'd love to be able to change it. Now, I will say this. This is a nice thing. In the alternative space, the W-2 income earners can do a lot more through alternatives than they could. They don't even have the option of like starting up a solo 401k unless it's, you know, maybe they have a side gig or something. But anyway, sorry, I stole it.
Keep that's perfect. Right. Okay, so the self-employed person, they can set up a solo 401k, and inside of that, they can decide what options they get to invest in. Oh, by the way, they can include all kinds of really cool stuff, real estate and you know, a lot of these alternative types of things that we talk about. So if you are a W-2 person, then it depends on where your money is in those retirement accounts. So for example, if the only money you have is with your current employer in a 401k, then you need to ask them the question, is it possible for me to move money out of my 401k to roll it into an IRA while I'm still working here? For some of you, the answer will be yes. For some, it'll be no. But if you can do that, or if you have money that you already did roll over from maybe from a previous employer's 401k and it's sitting in an IRA now, then you can do what's called a self-directed IRA, where the funds, it still has to be with a third party administrator, right? That a custodian that kind of helps you, you know, manage that and make sure that you don't
get the taxes right.
And do it wrong. But you can do that. And so then you can invest in all of these other things with your qualified money. It doesn't have to just be that you're picking the mutual funds or whatever that you're used to. That's what most people think. That's just what it is. An IRA equals investing in the stock market, and that doesn't have to be the case.
Okay, I think that's a great answer. I'm not even going to really add much to it. I think that if you're somebody who, you know, have been saving and want to get into the alternatives, then using a self-directed IRA or a self-directed solo 401k are great options to do that. Now, I want to be clear about this point before we move on. Mm-hmm. I still wouldn't make a significant emphasis on putting money into the qualified plan in order to invest in alternatives. Mm-hmm. I would prefer personally to take care of the tax, have control over the asset, and be able to, you know, make those determinations without having to kind of, for lack of a better word, be in bed with the IRS.
Yeah. Or instead of just accepting that you have to pay that tax, find a CPA that can help you get other alternative ways to create tax savings, true tax savings that I don't have to pay for now or ever.
Okay, Rod, we're going to switch gears here.
Okay.
You're considered by most, and certainly by me, as one of the foremost experts in all things life insurance. So, and specifically in the kind of designs that we do, max cash value, minimum cost, producing cash flow. So we have a couple of questions that are specific to the life insurance world. And this one, you would have to be kind of engaged in it to even know what we're talking about. So you're going to have to give a little bit of context here. But we've had more than one person ask us to kind of go through this question. And so I want to make sure we hit on it today. Okay, so here's the question. What exactly is this 7702 thing I've been hearing about? And how will it affect life insurance moving forward? So, okay, the 7-7, what does that even mean?
Yeah, let's start with
what it
is.
Give us a starting point.
Okay, so that's a section of the tax code. And what it deals specifically with is how life insurance cash value gets taxed. So there are, as you can imagine, it's the tax code. There are a lot of different elements
of course,
to
right.
it. But the the reason why it's come up recently is because there was a change made to the code last December that changes the way that a life insurance company can write policies, and then how the tax how that impacts the taxation on it. So if you've been in kind of close enough to the type of stuff that we do to at least have heard us talk about something like what's called a modified endowment contract, or what the life or what the IRS has as their definition of life insurance, then you know that there are specific things that we can do to make life insurance, cash value life insurance, act from a tax standpoint anyway, like a Roth. In other words, after tax dollars going into the account, but then anything that's coming back out, it comes out tax free. Okay, and we won't get into all the details on how we make all of that happen, but the tax code allows for that, as long as you follow their rules, and as long as the policy that you're putting your money into fits inside of their definition of life insurance. And so what the changes did was a couple of things. It dictated to the insurance companies what they have to include in their policies as the guaranteed rate of return. So for example, in a whole life policy, if you've been in that world over the last 30 years, then you know that the guaranteed interest rate on a whole life policy has been 4%. It wasn't by accident that all the insurance companies offered the same rate. It's because that's what was dictated inside of this code with the IRS. And with this change last December, they've loosened the rules a little bit. So the guaranteed rate can go as low as 2%, but the insurance company actually gets to pick it. And I've seen different things. Some of them say it is anywhere between 2%, 3.75, up to 4. Anyway, but the point is that now the insurance companies have a little more leeway when they're building a policy on what they want to offer as the guaranteed interest rate.
So what we're going to see, and on a practical basis, is we're going to see the ratio between guaranteed interest and the interest we receive in the form of a dividend kind of change that relationship, right? So instead of being 4% coming from the guarantee and 2% coming from the dividends, it might be the opposite way, right? It might be 2 and 4, but the reality is that this is a result of low interest rates for the last, 15 years now. And it's impossible not to make adjustments to make sure to be financially and fiscally smart as it relates to how these policies are built. Now, the nice thing is, let's put it this way. It sounds all bad, Rod. Initially, it sounds like that's not cool, right? So now instead of getting a guarantee 4, I'm only getting maybe a guarantee 2 or a guarantee 3. That doesn't sound good.
No.
Talk to us about both sides of this.
Yeah.
And what are maybe the potential pros that go along with it?
Yeah. So the other side of the coin is that it also, as it relates to this calculation or this formula that the IRS gives to the insurance companies to determine whether they fit that definition of life insurance. The theory goes like this. If I have a lower guaranteed interest rate on the policy, then because that changes other things inside of that formula, that means that I can put more money into that policy than I otherwise would when it was a higher guaranteed interest rate that was associated with it. And in our kind of world, the types of policies we build, is what that translates into is lower cost. I can have less cost in the policy and put more money into it, therefore actually create a higher rate of return. Even though the guaranteed return is lower, I have the potential of building a higher rate of return inside the policy as a result.
So we talk a lot about a concept we call a funding range, right? Our funding range represents the range of dollars that someone can contribute to their policy in a given year. And the way that we come up with the funding range is basically using this formula. So let's just say that someone's talking to us and they're putting an average type policy. They're putting $100,000 a year away to invest in syndications. And what that would represent, let's say it's a 45-year-old, something like that. That would represent a funding range of somewhere between $25,000 on the low end up to $100,000. So in other words, that means that in order to keep the policy running, we've got to get at least $25,000 in. That's not our goal, right? Our goal is to max fund that thing, get as much as we can so we can generate a better return. But that means, though, that the 25,000, that what we call base premium, that's kind of the taking care of the life insurance, and it's building cash value, right? So I think that's important to just kind of understand how that plays out. So let's go back to the funding range here, because then I can kind of move it back to how this helps. So let's say my funding range now is 25,000 to 100,000. That 25,000 carries a little bit more cost than the other 75,000. Mm-hmm. So what will happen inside of this 7702 or what's happening here is the likely scenario is that instead of having a funding range between 25,000 and 100, maybe it goes down to 17,000 and 100. In other words, the money that we can get directly into the second part of it, the paid up additions, we'll be able to get more money into the paid up additions because of this ratio change. Now, we don't know for sure how that's going to impact the actual policy, the actual return, but there is certainly potential for it to be as good or better over time. It'll just be hard to tell, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the updated law was written last December, so December 2020. But the companies have until this upcoming January to implement and make changes to those policies. And so my expectation is that around November, December, we'll see a bunch of these companies that'll come out and start introducing what they're doing. And as we always do, we'll be staying on top of that, making the comparison and understanding what the options are. And even within the same company, I wouldn't be surprised if they say, hey, we have this option over here where it's a 3.5% guaranteed interest rate. And then this option B over here, it's the same whole life type of chassis, but it offers a 2% guarantee. And then there'll be those, you know, implications that come with that in terms of the differences in building cash value or death benefit, whatever your goal is in the policy. So,
okay. All right, Rod. Well, man, now that we've put everyone to sleep, except those three people that, you know, wrote in and wanted to get some more. And I'm just teasing. This is something that will be impactful for, you know, the types of people we work with, because so many people have kind of grown into this concept and understanding that the investment optimizer strategy, it works, and just more and more people are doing it. So obviously for us, it has an impact, but I think that was a good overview of what we can kind of expect and what's happening on that.
Yeah. And our apologies real quickly, just for being a little bit vague on it. It does remain to be seen exactly how it's going to play out. The companies get to decide how they build their policies. And so we'll see what they do, but hopefully that at least gives some clarity and helps people see what's happening and kind of we'll have to see how it plays out.
Okay, well said, Rodney. Okay, here's the last question, Rod, and we're sticking on the life insurance theme, so I'm going to let you lead out on this one.
Okay.
Okay, Rod, what's the difference between direct recognition and non-direct recognition? That's the first part of the question. Okay. In fact, I'm just going to leave it at that. What is the difference between direct and non-direct recognition in life insurance?
So this is specifically relating to a whole life policy. And as we talk about with, for example, the investment optimizer strategy, we have cash value there and we're going to take a loan from the insurance company using the cash value as collateral. Well, when I do that, what this question ultimately gets at is how is the cash value that's still there in my policy growing, but now it's acting as collateral against the loan. Is it growing? And depending on whether it's a direct recognition policy / company or non-direct, that is going to determine that. So let's just real quickly, let's start with non-direct. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I have $100,000 in my cash value and I take a $60,000 loan, my full $100,000 stays in the account. And in this case, the full $100,000 continues to earn the guaranteed interest and the dividend the same way as it was. So there's no change to the way it earns and grows, regardless of whether I have the loan against it or not.
Okay. And this one is
non-direct.
Direct. I was just being silly.
Good. You were testing
me. Wanted to clarify, Rod. Okay. This one is non-direct recognition. And this is important. Okay. So maybe just say that one more time, Rod.
Yeah.
Just so it's super clear. The $100,000 example, I take $60,000 out, I have $40,000 in. describe again exactly what's happening on a non-direct basis.
Yeah. I took a $60,000 loan. That money came to me from the general account of the insurance company, which means that my full $100,000 stayed in the account. And and there's no change to the way that it grows as compared to when before I took the loan. It's the same.
Okay. Okay. So what actually, we're not going to get into the impact of that yet. Okay. Yeah, so that's an example. That's the first example.
Yep.
Now let's switch to direct.
Okay. So with direct recognition, same situation. I have $100,000 in my cash value. I take a $60,000 loan. The full $100,000 is still there growing, but there's a change in the way that the $60,000 that is acting as collateral, the way that it grows. And different companies will kind of treat it maybe a little bit differently, but really that's the key to it, is that there's a difference in the way it grows. And more specifically, the interest that it's earning is directly related to the interest that I'm paying on the loan. So I have a $60,000 loan. I'm paying interest. Let's say I'm paying 5% interest on that. Mm-hmm. The interest that I'm earning inside of my cash value on the policy, the portion that's acting as collateral, right? It is earning an interest rate that's directly related to that. Let's just say it's earning the same 5%. If I'm paying 5 and I'm earning 5.
We call it a wash loan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Because we're getting the same. And the interesting thing about these things is that there are pros and cons to both, to both of the ways this is put together. But the nice thing in this situation is that because it's always tied, it really doesn't matter what the market conditions are as much. I can make the strategy work regardless of, you know, market conditions. And so it's, so from that standpoint, it's pretty valuable. Okay. But I don't want to get too much into that yet, Rod.
Okay.
So the next part of the question is, why do I keep hearing that I should only consider non-direct recognition companies, especially if you're running in the infinite banking crowd?
Yes.
What's so special about that, the non-direct recognition, that makes it so popular amongst?
They say that when you take the loan, if I have a non-direct recognition, so let's just take the example of a company currently, and we try to avoid mentioning company names, just kind of gets us into trouble with them, and so we just avoid it. But there's a company right now that's paying 6% total between the guaranteed interest and the dividend, and the interest rate on the loan is 5%.
Okay, so there's a difference between 6 and 5, 1% spread.
Yep, I'm earning a percent more on the cash value.
That sounds pretty darn good.
Than what I'm paying. It does. Why wouldn't you want to do that? And
I think I do.
And that's the whole reason behind this. Is someone would say, you took that $60,000 loan and you're earning more on your cash value than what you're paying in interest, and that by itself creates more value for you. You're better off by having taken the loan than you would be if you didn't and you just left the money alone. Okay?
Okay, that sounds pretty cool. I can see why that's compelling. Intriguing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Whereas, I'll take the same situation on the direct recognition side. If I'm currently earning 6, we'll just call it 6, even though there isn't a direct recognition company that's paying 6 right now, but we'll say it's 6, and I'm paying, and now I'm going to pay 5% on the loan. Well, all of a sudden, the $60,000 that's acting as collateral is only earning 5 instead of 6. That's worse, right?
That does sound worse. Yes.
Okay. So it's pretty compelling so far. All right. But here's what happens.
So are you going to bring this together or is that just it?
Nope. Here it comes.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
Let's say interest rates go up.
Mm.
It may feel
that's
like they're
going to happen.
Yeah. That may feel like that's not going to happen. But let's just say, hypothetically speaking, in fact, there's a lot of concern with people right now because of inflationary things happening that's going to happen
well, here's
soon.
The thing.
And when it does it, it's going to go up quickly. Right. So,
So here's the thing. Like, we joke about this, but the reality is it's been low for so long that it's not a matter of when, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Yeah. And so at least being conscientious of what that looks like, I think is important. So, okay, keep going on.
So let's say in a month, interest rates go up and all of a sudden, instead of paying 5% on my loan, I'm paying 8. Okay.
Ooh, that doesn't sound as good.
If I'm in a non-direct situation, I'm earning 6 still on my cash value, but now I'm paying 8. all of a sudden, unfortunately, my positive 1% now turned into a negative 2%.
Okay. So that's important to be aware of.
Yeah. On the direct recognition side, if I'm now paying 8, I'm also earning 8. It's still a wash, right? And I think the more important thing on this is the difference between when I'm paying interest on my loan, I'm paying simple interest, but the interest that's growing inside of my account is growing on a compounding rate. And there's just a difference, right? Even if it's a wash loan, interest rates are the same. If I'm paying simple but earning compound over time, I'm just going to earn a lot more interest than what I'm going to pay on the loan.
So the value of being direct recognition, from my perspective, is that it works all the time. It doesn't make a difference what interest rates are doing,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
Because of that direct recognition or that direct link, it's just going to work.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, in the right situation, the right environment, then certainly having non-direct is super compelling, right? Because if I can create greater arbitrage, then I obviously want to be able to do that at any chance that I get.
Yeah. Here's the kind of the warning, I think, for people. If that's what you're hearing is that the only way to go is non-direct, and they kind of lay it out there, hey, you're going to pay 5 and earn 6 or you know, whatever the kind of that ratio is, but you're going to earn more than what you're paying just as a straight interest rate. Be careful with that, because
for sure, and
at the end of the day, think about it this way. Somebody who has this kind of a life insurance policy is going to be in that policy for the next decades, right? 20, 30, 40 years, depending on, you know, how old you are when you got it and when you die. But there will be times when non-direct is the better option between the two. And there will be times when the direct recognition is the best option between the two. The problem is I have to pick one, and that's what I'm going to have. And so for us, as we look at the landscape, we don't let that be the deciding factor on how we choose the company or how we choose the specific product that we recommend for our clients, because there are other factors that are much more important than this.
You know what's surprising, Rod? When we've run the numbers on this, and we have many, many times, but it's always surprising to me how little impact the loan aspect actually has on the overall cash value. So like you said, instead of putting emphasis on which type of whether we're going direct or non-direct, our emphasis is always on what company and what product within that company will build the most cash value, because those are the dollars we have to invest.
Yep.
And if I don't have as many, then it just drags everywhere. So anyway, for us, I just want people to understand that our priority list ends up being a little bit different than maybe a lot of people, in that the focal point is always on cash value first. And again, just because that's what matters.
Yeah.
That's what ultimately gives us the money to pay to start putting into the alternative asset investing.
Yeah, and put another way, for dollar, what someone's putting in the policy, we want the most cash value as a result, because that's what we can loan against and go and use for the investing. So,
and that's what we have control over.
Yes,
right. We don't have direct control over what interest rates are going to do in the future, but we can control that.
Yes. And sometimes it's a surprise to people when I say, oh, there's a dramatic difference between the different companies. Again, the same dollar amount going in, but how much ends up in the cash value over a long period of time with company A, you can just end up with a lot more than you do with company B. And it's just the way they're built. But the way the company is putting the product together specifically toward our goal, and that is maximized cash value, there's just a difference. And so it's much more important than, you know, comparing dividends between the companies. Well, who's paying the highest dividend, or this direct versus non-direct conversation. It's just a much more more impactful on the policy than these other things.
Well said. Okay, so that's 5 questions in, 5 questions answered. I think we're going to wrap this thing up. So before I do, though, just another quick shout out that if you have any questions you would like Rod and I to answer on the show, shoot us an email. My email is christian@moneyinsights.net, rod@moneyinsights.net. And we would love to hear from you. It makes it more fun to answer these questions when we know that there's specifically people who are looking for the answers. And, you know, it's always fun to be helpful in that way. And as always, if you like our stuff, then please give us an objective review. Okay, that has been the Money. This has been the Money Insights Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. And Rod, I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, visit moneyinsights.net.